if you're feeling depressed or you're having these negative thoughts, it's okay to talk about it. If you don't have anyone to talk to, please find me and I'll talk to you. But you know, if you're struggling with it, let somebody know. You know, I know you fight that urge, that urge of feeling like no one cares or that someone's going to look down on you. Let them know. And if you're someone who has a feeling that someone you love or that you know is struggling, man, just step up and ask them. But you know, let them know that, hey, you know, their secret's safe with you, and try to make them feel as comfortable as possible. But get them talking, because we don't need to lose anybody else over addiction or suicide. It's too freaking horrible, and life's too valuable. We will have to learn how to talk.
Hi folks, this is Santosh Shiva. Welcome to another episode of Run Yogi Diaries. It's my pleasure to be in conversation with Andre Herman, someone who is on a journey of ultra running, but through ultra running, finding his way out of depression, anxiety, and addiction. Every week, I bring you conversations with people who are on a journey of well-being through endurance sport. In today's episode, we touch upon an important topic that afflicts millions of people around the world and in America: mental illness. As per the National Alliance of Mental Illness, the largest grassroots body that is working to make lives better for people dealing with mental illness, 1 in 20 people in America are afflicted with mental illness. It hit home when my daughter was affected by anxiety and depression. It convinced me that, like all other physical illnesses that have societal support, mental illness needs understanding, awareness, and support from the society overall. Running and physical activity overall is recommended as a way to get better and deal with mental illness. We get to talk about what endurance means to his life. How did it at some point turn into an alcoholic addiction? How has he used ultra running to stay sober and find purpose in life? Let's dig in. Hey Dre, welcome to Run Yogi Diaries.
Hey, how you doing, man?
Doing great. Good. It's such a pleasure having you on the show.
Yeah, thanks for the invite, man. I'm really, really looking forward to talking to you today.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know, you have a very fascinating story of endurance, your journey in endurance sport, as well as what you're doing around the mental health area, which is very dear to me, the whole topic. So, you know, look forward to having that conversation, learning from you. So before that, I want to hand it back to you and have you do a quick introduction.
Hey, my name is Andre Herman, and I consider myself an endurance athlete. I live here in Sugar Land, Texas, and I am a full-time faculty member currently working as a department chair at Houston Community College for the Digital Communication and Digital Gaming and Simulation program. I've lived here in Texas for almost 7 years. I moved here with my wife and my family from San Francisco to work at Houston Community College. And I've been running for about, 13 years I've been running. And so I've been running for 13 years, half marathons, and I only recently started within the last 2 years. It's been 2 years that I've actually been running in ultra distance runs.
All right.
And I'm also a photographer by trade.
Nice. I like what you're doing in your professional life, by the way. That's another topic, the whole digital simulation and revolution that's happening around the country, and you know what you're doing, that's another topic. But hey, thanks for sharing that. I want to start with a fundamental question, right? Which is, what does endurance sport mean to you? What has it been for you in your life?
Well, endurance sports, primarily running long distances, plays a really vital role for me these days. As I mentioned in the introduction, I've been running half marathons since 2008. And that was really just maybe one run a year that I would never train for. So I wouldn't really say it really was a passion at that point. I think it felt more like a chore. And it really wasn't until the last few years when I got into ultra endurance, long distance running, that I really was able to start to understand who I was and where what running meant to me and how it fit into my personality and my life. And so the endurance sports really is has become a purpose for me. It's been a beacon and a guiding light to help me find my way out of addiction and control my depression.
Wow. And how is it, in what way is it helping you in those areas?
Well, how it's helping me is that it gives me an opportunity, a channel, right? It gives me an opportunity to take a break during the day and go out and just exercise, get my blood pumping. And I know that there's some people out there who'll say, well, running is not exercising, right? But it's still fundamentally, I'm out there and I'm moving and I'm getting my blood pumping and I'm just giving my brain an opportunity to just relax and take a break from worrying about things for a little bit.
Makes a lot of sense. You know, I have this theory, my own, I just made this up, which is that, you know, you have these different triggers in the day, which puts, at least for me, it puts me into this fight or flight mode, right? Yeah. It could be an email, it could be something that somebody said, or it could be a bad news or whatever, right? It puts me in a fight or flight mode. And when I go for a run, I actually simulate what I'm supposed to do when I'm in a fight and flight mode, which means that I'm actually running away from danger. Yeah. And in some way, my brain and my whole system kind of now recognizes that, okay, you've taken action. I just informed you have to fight or flight, and you can't be sitting on your desk and looking at the screen and releasing cortisol and getting up, getting stressed out. Going on a run just eases me out and relaxes me. And I completely relate to what you're saying. So that's what it does to me. So I completely relate to what you're saying.
Yeah, for me, when I get out on the trail, you know, I'm usually turning on music or a podcast. And what I sometimes find, especially recently, is that after a while, I'm not even hearing. Yeah. If you were to ask me, hey, what did you just listen to over that last 1 hour? I'll say, oh, I have no idea.
I agree.
Because my brain, you know, what I find is it becomes very hypnotic. When you're running on a trail, you're looking 3 feet ahead of you to make sure you're not hitting anything or tripping over anything. And after a while, you just forget about the things around you, and it becomes a very personal, almost spiritual moment. Yeah. Where you run, you know, I'll run 3 miles. I'm like, wow, that was fast. I don't even know what the hell just happened. Right.
Yeah.
So, but then there's other days where I go out and I'm like, man, I feel like I'm wearing 2 blocks of concrete. Everything's heavy. I really don't want to do this. And then it becomes a slog. I'm still doing, I still do it anyways. I just have to shift my mindset a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I agree with you. So, you know, I've always shifted between listening to something and just running as is. Yeah. And I've found that when I run, not listening to anything except my footsteps, those, like you said, it gets you into a trance. And a lot of times my thoughts are actually just circulating as I run. And that's enough of my own podcast running in my mind, right? It's like all this little chatter. And after a while, it goes away. And I get into this mode of silence and there's just the footsteps. And it's, it's an amazing experience.
Yeah, it really is. But, you know, on the other side of that too, I have to be really transparent with this, is that, you know, like you just said, you get out there and you get that chatter, or what some people refer to as monkey mind, right? Mm-hmm. Where it's just, it's that, I heard it referenced once as your inner roommate, right? And so when you have that thought about work or a person who's bothering you or a challenge, and then that voice, you hear that voice like, screw that person, or hey, you know, you don't do that. That's your monkey mind. And you know, I also heard someone once reference, you know, when you hear that, you got to find a big stick, a big literal stick, and figure out how to beat the monkey down. Right. So you can focus more on your running again. And so, you know, there are times where, like I said, I'll go out and run and it's just my brain is so busy. And it's usually when that happens is when I start to see my form break down, mm-hmm. things start to hurt sooner. And I just want to quit. And that, if I was to say that never happened, I'd be lying. I'd really be lying. So, you know, but that's more of a reflection of the bad days.
Yeah. Yeah. And how do you manage those bad days? What do you do?
You know, what I try to do is I try to find the stick, right? The biggest stick I can find to beat that monkey down and shut it up as fast as I can. And sometimes that, you know, if I'm not listening to anything, I'll turn something on. Mm. Music or an audiobook. And if not, what I'll do is I will start thinking about some sort of mantra, or I'll start thinking of maybe something I want to write. I'll try to shift the way how my mind is thinking to something that is more, I guess, neutral or as far away from what my brain is wanting to talk about as I possibly can. So for example, if the hurt starts turning on, right, where my legs, you know, because with the monkey mind, what ends up happening for me at least is, you know, I go out for a run and let's say it's one of those heavy days where it's just a slog and the monkey mind's like, hey, guess what? Your legs are about to start hurting. You feel those things yet? And I'm like, I don't want to hear those things. You know, I don't want to feel that yet. So then I have this mantra this thought that I think about, and it has to do with pain. And I remember hearing it once. I heard someone in a book mention it, that pain is just an energy. It's a naturally occurring energy in our body. And it's up to us whether we want to dam it up and keep it inside of us or just let it flow freely through us. Mm-hmm. And when we choose to take that pain or that fear or whatever it is and contain it inside of us, that's when it starts to run rampant and cause problems. But if we understand that it's an energy and we just let it, we understand that it's flowing in one end and it can easily flow out the other, it seems to smooth the wrinkles out of the sheet, so to speak. And so I start to think about that. Mm-hmm. I remind myself, hey, pain's just an energy, or hey, fear's just an energy. Where's it coming in? Oh, it's coming in through those legs right now, right? Yeah. I think, okay, how am I going to get rid of it? Breathe. All right. Every breath I'm expelling that energy, that negative energy. And then what that does is it gets me focused on my breathing now. Mm. And once I start focus on my breathing, well, now I'm no longer, that's the stick that beats the monkey mind down. Because now I'm focusing on breathing. Every breath is exhaling that negative energy. And now I'm not thinking about my legs anymore. I'm not thinking about monkey mind. Everything's quiet because I'm just focusing on breathing.
Yep.
And next thing I know, the miles have gone by. So... Yeah. You know, I would say that was probably one of the best pieces of advice I ever got from a really boring book once.
No, that's a very powerful insight. That's a very powerful insight. Yeah. And it's almost like, you know, reframing something that's happening to something that empowers you or supports you versus having that thing stop you and doing what you want to do, right?
Yeah.
So that's beautifully said.
I think it's like taking the very thing that's bothering you and turning it on itself, right? It's like reverse psychology. It's like, oh, it hurts. All right, well, let's figure out how we can take that hurt and use it in a positive way.
Yeah,
change the way we're thinking right now.
You know, you used a metaphor, you used the stick before, but for me, I think from what you're saying, it's not a stick. It's almost like, you know, the judo, there's a popular martial arts practice called judo, which people use. I don't practice judo, but what I've seen and heard people speak about is they don't fight or resist force. They actually redirect the force.
Right.
So that the opponent either falls or is you know, overpowered. So in what you're saying, it's almost like judo. It's almost redirecting and opposing energy to serve you versus, you know, fighting it and getting consumed by it. So that's great.
Yeah, I think you're right, man. That, you know, I think on the better days it's like judo, but then there's those days where it's just I'll be the first to admit sometimes that does the judo doesn't work. And now I'm in defense mode.
Yeah.
And that's when the damn stick comes out. I'm defending myself now just to get through those 3 to 6 miles, right?
Sword. Yeah. No, beautiful. So going back to your journey and how you got to where you got to, right? Early days. Were you an active person in your early days?
Yeah, I was really active. You know, I believe it or not, I actually ran in grade school and junior high. They, you know, we had to do it for PE class. So I never mind. I never had a problem with the running. And then they'd have like, I remember in junior high, they had, you know, there were like cross country events and I would run those. And those were like my earliest examples of running. But when I got older, I don't know, I think the running turned into skateboarding and snowboarding where I grew up. I had no interest in running anymore. It was just like, hey, let's skateboard. And so we'd go and skateboard all day long. You know, I have these very fond memories of my brother and I growing up where we spent a lot of our time walking everywhere. Walking really far distances, like across town to get to the comic shop, or just because, hey, it's boring. What else are we going to do right now? And so even going late, as I move through my life, there's one event that really, now that I ride and I do, and I run really far distances, I have this memory of when I was, I think 15, my parents were divorced and my brother and I were living with my dad. And one day I went down to the garage and I knew my dad had a 12-speed bicycle. And I told my brother, hey, I'm taking dad's bike and I'm going to ride mom's house. And my mom, this was in, we were living in Canyon Country, California. And my mom lived in Lancaster, California, which was about 50 miles away over some mountains. And I'm like, hey, dude, bye. I'm going to ride my bike. And he's like, are you kidding me? And I'm like, yeah, don't have a water bottle, don't have anything, but I'm going to ride through the high desert, you know, over to see my mom. And I got on the damn bike and I rode, you know, stopping at churches and places when I felt thirsty, but I rode. And the next 1 year later, I did it again. And I took another road, but I took the same bike. And so now I've been having memories of those events and I'm holding I'm really thinking about it like, wow, somewhere in my system or in my genes, I have this passion for adventure and the journey, so mm-hmm. to speak. And something in me drove me to ride my bike 45 miles when I was 15 and it didn't seem to bother me. It was more about the bike ride. Yeah. So, and then after that, I kind of dabbled in running again. After I graduated high school, I signed up for the Navy. I enlisted in the U.S. Navy and I thought, oh, well, let's start running. Maybe that'll help me with boot camp. And I learned the hard way that no, running wasn't going to help me with boot camp at all. I don't know. And it just kind of died out. Didn't exercise. I started drinking is what I did. Started to slowly build, watch that addiction start to build and set a foundation.
This was your early 20s?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Early 20s. And then when I got out of I drank all through the Navy and learned how to smoke and got out of service and kept smoking and drinking. And so it just kind of set the path for further addiction, mm-hmm. less exercise.
Yep. Yeah. Life just took over.
Yeah. Life took over in a weird way. I found it refining and redefining itself, because during those periods of time, you know, I had a certain clique of people that I was hanging out with. And so we'd go and hike in the mountains and things like that. But hey, we were smoking and taking our beers with us and everything. So we had these two energies canceling each other out.
Right. You know, while you say that, but your life's been functional in the sense that, you know, you have a family, you have a career. So while you say that, you know, addiction was taking over, but that hasn't stopped you from living a functional life, because we've also hear about stories where people lives are completely destroyed in something like that. So how did you manage to make sure that this wasn't really destroying you? While it was there, it wasn't serving you in the best possible way, but you seem to have managed it pretty well.
Well, you know, I think that's an interesting point. And I think in all honesty, I'd have to say, because I was young and I thought I was, you know, we have that immortality complex. We all do. I'm like, I'm young. I can survive this. You know, I'll keep doing it. What, you know, I still have a good amount of time under my belt. Right. And so, I didn't really think much about the drinking. I think it was really my first issue was with my smoking habit. Because I was smoking regularly. I mean, it was really getting, my addiction back then was smoking, because I was only drinking on occasion, but I was smoking constantly. Everything revolved around smoking. And so I finally realized, hey, I have to quit, because after a while I'd wake up and I'd have this clog in the back of my throat, this heaviness. And I'm like, I don't like this. And so it took me about 2 years to quit smoking completely, and I've never smoked again. But I think what ended up happening was I replaced the addiction of smoking with the addiction for drinking. Because after that, then, you know, I started to really discover drinking on a whole nother level. And I was introduced to red wine. And when that happened, it was all done, man. You know, I had a new love affair.
So this was like what, in your late 20s now? Where are you? Where in your life are you?
It was late 20s. It was probably early 30s. Late 20s, early 30s. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I lived in Venice Beach at the time. So there was this, we were living in this surf culture where, hey, go to work. After work, you surf in the afternoon, come home, and let's cook dinner and drink and have people over. And that was a common occurrence. It was slowly being programmed that, hey, alcohol was a normal addition to my everyday life. And if it wasn't there, there tended to be a problem. And if we didn't have it, let's go find it.
Right. So, you know, one question I have is, how does one know, how do you distinguish between calling it an addiction versus, you know, everyone drinks, right? I mean, it's a common thing. How do you know one versus the other? I mean, culturally, for example, wine especially, right? In the Western culture, wine is consumed every day in some cultures, right? Like if you talk about French and if you talk to Germans, they have beer every day. Yeah. So how does one know, or how did you know to call it addiction versus, hey, I'm just having a moderate amount of fun every day? You know, how do you know that?
Well, that is a very complex question to answer. Hmm. And that was the reason I say that is because, I really didn't start asking myself that question until probably about 4 or 5 years later. When I started to sense that I had a problem. Because I had met my I was dating my girlfriend, And then we moved to San Francisco, the Bay Area. I started making beer. And I was like, hey, I want a job in the beer industry, right? So I started making beer, and I had beer constantly around the house. So every time I'd go into the stash and pull out, a six pack. And so it was like drinking water. What I started to find was that then every time I went grocery shopping, we were always buying alcohol and wine. And it was slowly continuing to become a part of everyday life, where it was like, hey, lunch, have a beer. Hey, dinner, have a beer, and then have a glass of wine. And it started becoming more and more and more complex, to where I started to worry about it. And I started to wonder, I remember my mom telling me, hey, we have alcoholism running in our family. And I know that your dad does too. And so I started looking in a little bit deeper into that and asking, and started to find out that in fact, yeah, alcoholism ran in both sides of my family. So that was the first red flag that came for me, that I was starting to worry a little bit that maybe if I don't try to control this, what might be waiting down the road, mm-hmm. or what might be headed my way. And so even though I entertained that thought, it didn't really get in the way of me slowing down. And so to get back to your question, people drink all the time, but what separates an alcoholic from everybody else? And that question would oftentimes bring me to tears. I'm laying in bed at night, this is really near the height of my alcoholism before I quit. I was always asking, why can't I just drink like a regular person? And I think the best way to answer that question is the drinks, the alcohol, became the most important thing in my life. I couldn't go anywhere without drinking. I'd take a road trip with my family, and the first thing I would ask my wife while we're, on the road, we'd say, all right, time for lunch. And she'd say, hey, here's the town, let's stop here. I'm like, hey, where is there a brew pub or a brewery there? That tends to be a problem when the very first thought for food is, hey, where can we get beer? I don't care about the food. Let's just have, where can we drink? When it becomes the most important thing, to where it's dictating the choices that you make in your life, I think that's when it becomes a problem, is when all you're thinking about is alcohol. When you're thinking, hey, I can't wait for tomorrow at 12 o'clock because it'll be lunchtime and I can drink. That's where we start to separate between the people who can drink casually and the people who have a problem. It gets even worse when you get to the point to where you start hiding it. And hiding it from people, or going really far out of your way to make sure that no one sees it. When I found myself in that position, that's when I really, really knew. I was really convinced at that point that, yeah, I have a problem.
Thanks for sharing that. Yeah. I think this is very valuable.
I want to make it clear here too, is I don't want to create the idea here that because that was how it was with me, that everyone experiences it the same way, because we're all different. And alcoholism or addiction affects everyone on a completely different level. There may be similarities, but what I just explained may be completely different than, let's say, what you might have experienced, or what you may be experiencing, or somebody else. So I just want to make sure that I don't want anyone to hear this and say, oh, well, I'm not experiencing exactly what he did, so I'm obviously not an alcoholic. Because it comes in, if you've ever been, ask anyone who's ever been to an AA meeting or an NA meeting or any of the anonymous meetings, you'll hear as many people in the room as there are, you'll hear a different story of addiction, so just something, so a little disclaimer there, something to keep in mind.
So now, what about running? Now, while you were you also running and bicycling while all this was happening, or that was something that came up later?
Yeah, I've been writing a lot about this over the last few years. It's been a part of, I keep a journal. So I've found the benefit of keeping a journal that I can go back and relive some of these horrible thoughts and experiences. And, you know, when I moved here to Houston, I immediately started looking at half marathons and signed up for the Ramco half marathon. And I was like, hey, we're here. Let's start seeing where all the drinking spots are at. No, hey, how about it? Let's throw in a half marathon because I know there'll be free beer there, right? Or they'll be drinking afterwards. And what I started to find was that, and I didn't really realize it until years later when I started to sober up, was that extreme sports and endurance sports go hand in hand with beer. I had even signed up for a bike team here in Houston where it's like, hey, come and sign up, come and ride, you get free beer afterwards. And so after a while, it was like, hey, I'm going to ride. You know, it's at one point it was just like, oh, okay, I'm going to go and ride, but I can't wait for the beer and the food afterwards. You know, and I started to find that there was this shared attitude that, hey, you know, I ride so I can drink, or I drink so I can ride. And, you know, I was a believer. I shared that attitude with a lot of people for quite some time. And that, when I sobered up, that whole opinion, that whole way of thinking completely changed for me. And it really gave me an opportunity to really, I found myself looking at extreme sports and endurance sports in a whole new light now, asking, well, wait a minute, why is beer so deeply rooted in these sports for? I had even reached a point where I was reaching out to people asking, hey, you know what? I see that you're offering beer at the race. Why not carbonated water or non-alcoholic beer or something? And it just seemed that no one was really interested in doing that, you know? And so to get back to the point, yeah. At the height of my addiction, yeah, it was, hey, I can't wait to ride my bike so I can drink. How fast can we get this bike ride done so I can get back to the beer garden and drink? And by the way, as soon as I get home, I'm going to stop by the store and buy more beer. And hey, I'll get a bottle of wine that I can share with my wife. Right. And so, I found myself in an awkward situation because, you know, I knew I needed to quit, but does that mean I have to quit the sports as well? And that was a trigger that triggered me to start looking for memoirs of endurance athletes who were sober or who were battling addiction and were finding the light at the end of the tunnel or guidance through endurance sports. And that led me into where I'm at now. I started researching and reading these memoirs, listening to them, and then that inspired me to go down a new path, so to speak.
So how many years have you been now, you know, on this path of being sober and completely off alcohol?
Two years. Awesome. March 18th will be, I'll be 2 years sober March 18th.
Yeah. Awesome. No, that's very profound. And thanks for sharing. Yeah. It's a, you know, for folks, you never know who's dealing with this out there, right?
And you don't, man. I had, you know, so I continued to ride with this particular team, and I continued to maintain those relationships with some of the people that I met on that team. But then what I would do is I'd go afterwards and I'd sit down and people are like, hey, why aren't you having your beer? And I'm like, hey, I'm sober now. And they're like, oh, dude, I'm sorry. And I'm like, I'm sorry because I'm not drinking, or I'm sorry because I triggered something. And I'm like, dude, don't even worry about it. Just, they're like, how can you even be here right now? I'm like, you know what? I feel good enough that I can sit here with everyone else having beer, and I'm having my root beer or my water or whatever. Just thanks for acknowledging, but let's carry on.
Yeah. All right. So last 2 years, you said your whole approach to endurance sports has changed, right? And you've taken on some larger projects. You've ventured into ultra running. So tell us a little bit about, you know, the ultra running scene. What have you been up to and what have you done so far in the ultra running?
Well, you know, it really starts, I have to give a brief history of it, because it was 2017 is when I really started to listen to, you know, I really started to listen to read and listen to some of the audiobooks about these ultra endurance athletes. It was the fall of 2017. I had quit. I remember I went through a number of relapses trying to quit. And, I remember, and then 2018, I spent a lot of time just reading more books and running, just trying to really try to find myself, gaining some knowledge and running and trying to not drink. And 2018 was a big year of just bouncing back and forth, relapse, come back. And then it was finally 2019 is where I said, okay, I'm really inspired now. I'm really interested in the Leadville. After reading all the memoirs, I'm like, oh, there's just something really romantic about running really far distances in the mountains, right? I want that adventure. There was something inside of me that really wanted to go and discover and embrace the adventure of trail running. I thought there was something there for me. So 2019 came and I said, okay, now it's time. Let's start finding some races to sign up for. The very first race I signed up for was, it was a 20-mile trail run, and signed up for that. And I was like, okay, this is my half marathon for the year. And so did that. Said, okay, well, what's that? That was fine. What's next? So I signed up for my first 50K. So I signed up for three races. It was a 50K and then it was a 66K. And I think that year we had a big storm come through and it threw off the scheduling a bit. So I ended up finding myself in this really odd situation because I ran a 50K out at Brazos Bend State Park, which is completely flat. Okay. That was my very first ultra run. Couldn't get any flatter than that. The next one after that was a 66K. It was the Rattler 66K, which was put on by Lifetime, which was the same organization that does Leadville. All right. I had Leadville in my mind. I wanted to run that 66K because I knew that there was a lottery there that as long as you finished under the cutoff time, you could put your name in the hat to get a Leadville 100 token, right? And that token would guarantee you a spot in the Leadville 100. So it just so happened that I run the 50K, and because of that storm, all the schedules got shifted around. And next thing I know, I'm running two ultra marathons back to back, one weekend after the other. And I'm like, really? I'm like, okay, sweet. So I ran the flat one, and then I ran the 66K, and that it was just like, wow, I just did two half marathons in 2 weekends. Hey, I'm feeling all right. This is pretty sweet. But it was the 66K that was really of the most significance, because I chose it specifically because I wanted in to the Leadville 100. I dropped my name the previous fall, 2018 in the fall. I dropped my name in the lottery, I think in December, October, later in the fall. I dropped my name in. I didn't get chosen. So I said, okay, I'm going to go and run this race. And as long as I finish under the cutoff and hang around till the end, maybe I can get a token. So I ran it. I finished it, dropped my name in the hat, and no shit. At the very end, they called my name and they said, here's your token, put your name on the list. You're in, you're going to run. You tell us, do you want to run the 2019 or the 2020? And I'm like, oh, let's see. I can't run the Leadville 100 in 4 months. Right. So I postponed it to 2020. But the whole drive home from that, I drove home from the hill country just looking at this token in my hand saying, holy crap, I wanted it. And somehow the universe conspired and gave it to me. So now what am I going to do with this now? And it was that one sole event and getting that token, which set the next year and a half, 2 years completely on fire for me. It was the last nail in the coffin for my addiction. Because after that I said, okay, in order for me to be successful at Leadville, I have to be in the best shape of my life. And right now I'm considered overweight for my age and my size. If I can't lose the weight and get into the physical place I need to be to be successful at this, I need to quit. And at that very moment when I said that, man, that became my purpose. Nothing else mattered. I mean, besides my family and things like that, at that point, that ultra running and eating healthy and training became my main purpose that helped me find my way out of addiction.
Beautiful. Yeah. Very, very beautiful. Very inspiring.
And I quit. I never thought of, I can't say I never thought about drinking, because I don't think that it ever goes away. I really don't think it does. There were times but I never felt the need to drink, but every once in a while I'd be like, oh, we're having, we're going out to dinner tonight to an Italian restaurant. Oh, red wine. Oh yeah. I'm not drinking that. Oh, okay. Whatever. But otherwise, man, once I hit that point and I realized and I set it in stone, hey, this is my purpose. Nothing's getting in my way. I will succeed. I never thought about it again. I never battled an urge to drink ever again. And I started exploring fitness. I started exploring weight training, eating healthy, and reading a lot more books. And, for me, I feel like in a way I was kind of lucky, because I was listening to how people were struggling with their addictions. And I'm like, man, what's wrong with me? Because I hear all these people relapsing and have it really struggling. And somehow I know that I relapsed for 2 years. I dealt with that. But as soon as I found this purpose and I dedicated myself to it and to this long-term goal, it seemed to completely silence all of those negative internal voices. I'm like, I felt kind of odd. I kind of felt, am I doing something wrong? Is something not happening here? What's up? It doesn't seem to really be an issue for me anymore. And I started to feel like I was experiencing like an imposter syndrome, amongst all these other recovering addicts. I'm like, am I really a recovering addict? Because I don't really feel like I'm struggling like everyone else is. And that's still something that I question to this day is, I have that feeling of, was I really an addict? Was I really an alcoholic, or was it something else? I'm not really sure.
Right. And I think what I'm hearing and taking away from your story is that something as big like training for an ultra,
yeah,
helps you stay and focused on what, healthier choices that you want to make for yourself, right? It's a personal choice, and yeah, you made the choice, but having something big like this helps you stay focused on that. Yes. Versus getting derailed. And, because the world we live in, the environment we live in, is there's constantly someone selling something to you. And if you're someone who's trying to get off alcohol, you walk out anywhere or you see advertisements, there's enough of it coming and flashing on your face, right? And there's enough of people talking about the good benefits of alcohol. I mean, it's not easy. It's not easy for someone but I think what I'm hearing is when you have something as big and a big project like that, it helps you stay focused and stay focused, true to your commitment. And I think that's a good takeaway for
it's result based. So for me, I agree with you. That is a big point. And you know, I've shared this quite a bit. I follow a lot of the recovery groups and I interact with them on Twitter. And, you know, I share a lot with them about purpose. You find yourself a purpose, find something that you can dedicate yourself to that, you know, okay, start small with something for yourself. But if you can't find something for yourself, then go a little bit bigger and find something that's bigger than you to become your purpose that you can give to, that's something that has small, relatable results. So you are now accountable to those results. And for me, it was training and conditioning for this long-term goal, because I knew that the only way I'd see results in the changing of my body, developing strength and running faster, was if I quit, right? And so I wanted to see those results. And so that every day I said, hey, I don't want to drink anymore. I need to lose this weight. I need to get to a healthy place, a strong, healthy, well-conditioned place, because I want to finish the damn race. Yeah. You know, I know it's hard, and everyone keeps saying, look, you know, you're a flatlander going up to Leadville to run. The only advice that really ever made sense was go up there in the best condition of your life. You know, you can't really train for the altitude, but go up there in the best condition you possibly can. And I made that my goal.
Makes sense. So from a training point of view, how are you in Houston? Not many places where you get hills, even mild hills. So how are you training for those tough hills coming up? And when is the race, by the way?
The race is August 18th.
Okay.
I am. I have a weight training and running plan. I'm working in phases right now. So I'm still in the first phase, which is just really kind of building an endurance engine and basic weight training right now. I'm not so worried about the hills yet. It's still building the endurance up. I do run in like Memorial Park, the trail systems there that have some elevation. And then I do box steps. I have a plyometric box. So part of my strength training is step ups, lateral step ups, and just regular step ups right now. But as time moves on and we get closer, yeah, I'll be doing long distance runs like at Huntsville State Park and then up in Hill Country to get more of the elevation. And I foresee more doing step repeats at the parking garage, the steps.
Yeah. That's good. That's a good alternative if you don't have a mountain. Yeah. You're not living in mountains.
Yeah. So, you know, so I was scheduled to bring Leadville back up into this again. So I was scheduled technically to run the Leadville 100 last year, right? So when the early last year, I was like, oh man, here it comes this August. And then COVID hit. And I was like, oh, please, you know, I hope this COVID thing is only a short, you know, flicker of an instant and that I can still run Leadville. And by April, I think by April or May, all of the races were canceling. And I'm like, please, Leadville, don't cancel right now. And I'm like, I don't want that email. I don't want it. And then finally I got the email. Hey, sorry, we're postponing this. I'm like, really? I have to wait another year? But I think it was all in good. I think it was a blessing because it gave me another year to really focus on my strength and my endurance. But one really interesting thing they did was to replace that. They said, okay, well, we can't have you here. So we're going to create a virtual event that we call the Leadville 100,000 Foot Challenge. And as I said, okay, you got 2 months to gain as much as you're going to run, walk, bike as much as you can to gather up to 100,000 feet of elevation gain. And I'm like, how am I going to do this in Texas? And so for the next 2 months, I was running the hill country, and then I became very, very, very familiar with a 7-floor parking garage right down the street here, where I went to every morning. And one hour of steps up and down that parking garage gave me about 2,000 feet of elevation. And so every morning for 1 to 2 hours, I was doing freaking stairs, man. And wow. I was able to get the buckle for that. So
wow, yeah. That's amazing. That's a great way to also get your fitness up to the level.
Yeah, people in flatlanders don't forget about the parking garage steps.
I like that. And talking about Leadville, what you also are raising funds for NAMI, you know, in this process, and you want to raise awareness on the mental health issue. And it's another kind of pandemic in the world now, you know. And you know, so talk to us a little bit about that. What are you trying to do? How are you trying to support this organization, and what do you have as an end goal in this mission?
So, like I said, I mentioned earlier, you know, endurance sports was a major, it became a major driving force for me. It helped guide me through addiction, and also help, manage my mental health and my depression. What I told myself I do is now, once we got into 2021 and Leadville was in sight, and that it was actually going to run, I said, all right, well, what I want to do is, it's really been about myself up to this point. I feel comfortable with myself now and where I'm at. Now it's time to up the game. And I really wanted to take ownership of this on a whole nother level. So I started telling everybody that, hey, I'm running this 100 miles in August. And I realized that, hey, you know what? I could do a lot more with this. Is that, hey, I'm saying that I'm doing it, but who else would benefit from this? And so, you know, I've watched my daughter struggle with anxiety. And it's not a pretty picture. It's as a parent, it's very stressful. And when you're seeing yourself struggle with anxiety and depression, and then you know how to handle it yourself personally, but now when you have a family member struggling with it, your brain kind of goes blank and you're like, how do I handle this? Oops. And so I it really got me thinking, you know, how many people out there are struggling, especially now after COVID, how many people are struggling with some form of mental illness, in the form of one personally struggling with that, like an addiction or depression or suicide or all three, but also what about the family and friends who are struggling with it? They're secretly, or they're watching a loved one or a friend suffer, but they're not sure how to talk about it, right? And so I wanted to take this as an opportunity to really bring this to everyone's attention. And I thought that, hey, you know, if I'm already doing this, I wanted to really make it for something. I really wanted to give back and help raise awareness for these important issues and make this not just about myself, but for something much bigger, much bigger. And so I spent a lot of time asking friends, hey, is there an organization that you relate to? You know, Do you know somebody who's someone who's suffering or seeking help through an organization? What would be the best organization to help support? So I did quite a bit of research, and I chose a group to raise funds for.
No, that's a great move from your end, and we'll share that link in the show notes. So
but I think, you know, I want to stress the point that, you know, for myself, struggling with depression and addiction and suicide, you know, I didn't really know of any resources. I never told anybody. I kind of quietly suffered with it. Besides talking to a doctor to find medication for it, It was not something that I openly talked about because there is a stigma to it. It's like, you know, the moment you mention depression or suicide, immediately the person you're talking to gets extremely uncomfortable. And they either don't want to listen or they don't know how to listen. And then they immediately think that you're a weak person or there's something wrong with you or, hey, you want attention. And so I lived with that for quite some time that I'm like, you know what, I'm feeling a certain way. I'm not sure what it is or where it's coming from or how long I've had it, but I don't know what to do about it. And that led to me finally going to a doctor in my late 20s and saying, hey, look, you know, I keep having suicidal thoughts. I'm feeling really dark and depressed and I just don't feel happy and about anything. And he's like, you know, based on what you just said and your body language and everything, he's like, I think you're seriously depressed. And then I went through the whole mess of trying to find the right medication to balance myself out. And through that process, I started asking questions about my family. I'm like, okay, well, do we have a history of depression in our family? And this is where it got really, really personal because I started to make a connection with my dad. And I had memories of my dad where he was never happy. And it wasn't until later before he passed away that, you know, he finally admitted that, yeah, you know, I've been struggling with depression for a really long time. And even he never talked about it. Until after, you know, the one thing that I felt really good about was, you know, when I finally went to the doctor and started seeking help and talking to a psychologist about it, that my dad started asking me questions. He's like, hey, what are you doing for that? And I explained the whole process. And then he quietly started going to a doctor and he finally admitted one day that, hey, you know, I went and talked to a doctor and I got medication and started to feel a little bit better. And I was like, wow. I had no idea. And that's freaking horrible, man. That's horrible.
Totally. So thanks for sharing that. I think, you know, it's been a very profound, powerful, and enlightening conversation with you, Dre. Thanks for sharing your story and, you know, what you're up to. And this is really awesome. I want to move to the last part of our conversation, which is a lighter part of our conversation. I have a rapid fire round on, of course, related to running and ultras before we kind of wrap up. Okay. So you ready for it?
Sure.
Okay. So the first question I have is share with us three folks who inspire you in the area of fitness and endurance.
Oh my gosh. All right. So Rich Roll was one of them. And I have to say that, I have to say thanks to Rich Roll because he was one of the first people to help me because I remember when I was struggling with addiction and I was at the very end of it and really needing help. I kind of sent a message in a Twitter bottle to him. And I said, hey, man, I read your book. I follow your feed. I need some help. And he responded almost instantly with talking to me with some help. And that was, man, that helped change everything. I read the book by Dean Karnazes, Scott Jurek, all the famous people. There's one other guy, Superman. I forget his name right now. Hold on. David Clark. I have to put it out to David Clark. He passed away last year. But David Clark, he suffered from the same thing. And man, that guy was an inspiration to many, including myself.
Awesome. you know, you talk about Rich Roll. I think I've read his book too, and his story is very similar to yours, almost, right? And in fact, his podcast inspired me to start this podcast.
Awesome.
So if he ever listens to this, I want to thank along with you that he inspires a lot of people, and he's just an amazing human being. Absolutely. Awesome. So this is ultra trivia. Let's see if you can guess it. Do you know the first known ultra running event in the US or globally? Which year was it? Take a wild guess.
19, ultra running. So you mean more than a marathon?
Yeah. Technically an ultra running, which is more than a marathon. The first time
I believe it was the early 20th century. I think it was 1909, and there was a foot race across the country. I believe. Am I close?
You're pretty close. You're pretty close, actually. It's 1928. Coast to coast foot race was organized. No, that's pretty cool. You're up to speed with trivia.
Yeah.
So this is the next one, right? Again, another trivia in ultra running. There is a common agreement among the ultra running community as the race which is the hardest ultra running race. Which one is it?
In the world or in the States?
In the world.
Oh, in the world. Oh my gosh.
In the US? I mean,
there is. You know, everyone, every race, almost every race, there are certain races that claim that theirs is the hardest. I would have to say that it is, it's on the tip of my tongue. It's not Leadville. It's the other one in Colorado.
Hard Rock. Is it the Hard Rock?
Yeah, Hard Rock.
Hard Rock. Okay.
I would say Hard Rock 100.
Okay, so this one you didn't get it.
Okay,
at least from what I found was the common agreement is that the Badwater
is
the hardest one because it's got 19,000 feet of elevation gain, 135 miles, and it happens in 120 degrees Fahrenheit.
Right.
And I don't even know if this is a scientific opinion or something like that, but this is what I found on Google. So, but Hard Rock is tough too, is what I've heard. What's your favorite guilty pleasure from a food perspective?
From a what? From a food? Oh gosh, almighty! Whipped cream, homemade whipped cream.
You like to binge on that?
I make my own whipped cream.
And it's, all right.
Oh man, that's awesome.
That's a good guilty pleasure. And you're also a coffee connoisseur, right? You make good coffee, don't you?
Yeah, I really do love coffee. Yeah, yep. So I'll make the homemade whipped cream, and then we'll put it in our coffees. So
yeah, that's what I was thought. That was where I was going with it. what would be a dream location for you to run, other than Leadville, of course? That's already in the book. So.
Oh. You know, I would really love to run. I would really love to run something like New Zealand, Grand Canyon, Zion National Park. I think.
Awesome, beautiful. Hopefully, we'll see you do all those the next 3 years, or a couple of years at least. Hey, that was a. An awesome conversation, Dre. Appreciate you taking the time out and spending this afternoon on this podcast. And we're going to wrap up shortly. Any final wrap up comments before we close out?
You know, the only thing that I would really end with is that, you know, if you're feeling depressed, or you're having these negative thoughts, it's okay to talk about it. You know, if you don't have anyone to talk to, please find me and I'll talk to you. But, you know, if you're struggling with it, let somebody know. you know, I know you fight that urge, that urge of, you know, of feeling like no one cares or that someone's going to look down on you. Let them know. And if you're someone who has a feeling that someone you love or that you know is struggling, man, just step up and ask them. But you know, let them know that, hey, you know, their secret's safe with you, and try to make them feel as comfortable as possible. But get them talking, because we don't need to lose anybody else over addiction or suicide. It's too freaking horrible, and life's too valuable. We'll have to learn how to talk.
Absolutely. And what's the best place to reach you? Would it be on your web through your website, or would it be on Facebook? I can share those.
You know, Twitter. You can find me on Facebook, and you can find me on Twitter, right. Andre Herman 11. I can send that to you, and you can add it to the show notes. But you know, there's a really big group of recovering addicts on Twitter that are always there's always someone on there 24 hours a day helping. But then also NAMI. NAMI also has the 800, the numbers to call, and they also have all kinds of classes and references and resources for both sides of the mental health table. So I would highly suggest you go to their website. Like, I wish I knew about the website decades ago when I was struggling. I think it would have helped me out immensely, but I'm glad I know about it now, so I can share it with everybody else.
Sure. Sure. Hey, Dre, thanks a lot. Very powerful conversation again. Have a wonderful rest of the afternoon, and we'll stay in touch.
Hey, thanks.
Bye. Take care.